This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Neurothera from Claire Labs. Your brain's complex metabolism requires many different nutrients for optimal performance. Neurothera is a broad-spectrum neuronutrition formula that supports the central nervous system and cognitive capacity. Used daily, Neurothera supports mental clarity and cognitive function. It provides the essential building blocks for optimal brain health. For more information and to purchase Neurothera, just go to my online dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and once again, it's time for our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Your questions come to us via radio program at AOL.com, and assisting me capably today, as usual, is Layla, whose name is imparted to this podcast, because it is the Q&A with Layla. So how can it be the Q&A with Layla without Layla? She's indispensable.
Say my name some more times.
She's indispensable. She's indispensable to this podcast. And it also affords me the greater likelihood of getting a correct answer, because we get two bites at the apple to your questions. Questions come to us, once again, via radio program at AOL.com. And we got a bunch of questions this week, but I wanted to comment on this story, first of all, because it's about nutrition, mm-hmm. and secondly, because it's about anthropology. And as some of you already know, I'm an anthropology major, majored in anthropology at Columbia College, back, oh, way back when, in the Paleolithic era, and that was many, many years ago. But I always had a love for anthropology, because and one of the reasons I gravitated to anthropology is because anthropology tells us so much about our human natures, our human makeup. And also it affords us an opportunity to look at other cultures, particularly...
So it was cultural anthropology that you were majoring in, not physical anthropology.
Right.
Which is a little different.
Which is different, but there was a big component of physical anthropology, which is the study of fossils, and the study of prehistoric man. So, so then, obviously, that gave me... a perspective in medicine, which is that we respect mm-hmm. the cultural practices of other peoples, like Asian medicine, ancient Asian medical practices have come to the fore, acupuncture and all this stuff. So it gave me an appreciation and a tolerance for other practices, but also...
And a cultural competence.
Yeah.
Which is...
Yeah, to navigate from one culture mm-hmm. to another. And that helps also in working with patients, because patients come to us with different cultural expectations. But anyway, it also informs our discussion of what is the proper human diet. Mm. And this has been embodied in the paleo movement.
Yes.
But it sort of depends on who's paleo. Now, when I was a vegan, mm-hmm. We used to argue that, look at monkeys. Monkeys are primarily vegetarians. Well, that is until they get hungry and they eat their young.
Yes.
So they're not really entirely, they're mostly vegetarian, but mm-hmm. They do eat some animal protein. But the idea is that we descended from apes, and apes are primarily vegetarians. Mm-hmm. Gorillas, for example, they don't go out and, kill an antelope or, wildebeest and devour them.
Right.
They mostly are, they're big and strong. And, you can't quarrel with the strength of a majestic gorilla. And look how they get there. They eat vegetables. Mm-hmm. So this is like one of the arguments that's mustered by vegans and vegetarians. But we have to look at the actual anthropological record. And so there's a fascinating article here about a new study that suggests that humans hunted for meat 2 million years ago. Now, some people may say, well, of course, yeah, humans hunted for meat. We know that. But actually, what's interesting about this is that puts the timeline back 1.6 million years, because previous to this finding, it was thought that humans started evolving from our vegan or vegetarian ancestors towards eating meat only 400,000 years ago.
Okay.
That was the previous site where they found butchered animal parts. But here, they, in the old Duvai Gorge, which is where, you know, James Leakey found, you know, the Australopithecines and, you know, these human precursors.
Australopithecus,
right. Uh-huh. And Lucy.
Lucy, I remember Lucy.
Is the first proto-human. Anyway.
Yeah.
So the point of this study is that they actually found that humans were deliberately hunting and killing animals 2 million years ago.
Wow.
And so that's a lot of time for human anatomy to get used to eating meat.
Yeah.
And to say that it's like a relatively new, unnatural thing that we're eating so much meat, well, no, it's been going on for 2 million years. So
yes.
Clearly the paleo diet, you know, while it didn't consist of solely meat.
No.
There's a lot of roots and vegetable, mm-hmm. roots and berries and, you know, other gathered foods.
Mm-hmm.
There was also, there was a lot of animal protein. And the theory is, you know, how did humans get to have such big brains?
Smaller jaws.
Right.
Yeah.
There's an energy cost to mm-hmm. having a big brain. First of all, it's heavy.
Mm-hmm.
But secondly, it's very energy requiring.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there had to be a great leap forward in human nutrition to provide adequate caloric support for the brain. And where do those calories come from? Well, if you want to get them from vegetables, you got to eat all day.
You have to eat a barrel of them.
Yeah.
And that's still not enough calories, likely.
And that doesn't leave a lot of time for, the theory is social activities, cooperative
sure.
activities. It's basically.
And it's a lot of chewing.
Yeah, it's basically you're foraging all day, you know.
Yeah.
And so the brain got better nourished. The brain evolved mm-hmm. more so that more and more coordinated hunting could occur.
Mm-hmm.
Humans managed to make extinct most of the large mammals that inhabited, they used to have giant sloths and they used to have, giant cattle and, you know, these big, big animals that were hunted, mastodons and mammoths
mm-hmm.
that were hunted to extinction. And they weren't hunted to extinction overnight. They were hunted to extinction over hundreds of thousands of years.
Yeah.
It's just a phenomenal, inconceivable amounts of time occurred before written history, you know.
Yeah.
And all during that time, humans were adapting to their environment. And now, we've dissociated from our environment. We eat processed foods. Many of us have chosen to stop eating animal protein.
We live indoors.
For humanitarian reasons, perhaps, but maybe that's not entirely natural for humans. I mean, humans have a great deal of flexibility. They can
mm-hmm.
eat a variety of foods and still survive.
That's true.
So anyway, so our anthropology understanding informs our nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
It informs our understanding of medical practices. It's a cool discipline.
It is. It really is. And, you know, it speaks to the movement of the paleo diet, or the paleo diet movement, I should put it.
Yeah.
In why and how our genetic makeup is pretty much based on all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And hasn't changed all that much. However, then there's the argument that it's the microbiome, it's not so much our genetic makeup, but the genetic makeup and the microbiome of our microbes.
Which chew up our food and process our food.
So there's that to consider.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You almost want to call it a middleman.
Right.
And then what we're able to consume or tolerate or not. It's all very interesting stuff.
So it's you are what you eat? No, it's not. You are what your microbiome renders to you.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
You are what your
almost
microbiome
like
eats.
Almost like a gatekeeper.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, well, enough of a digression. Let's get to the real heart of the matter, which is the questions.
Yeah. Actually, we have a comment from a reader who was listening to the podcast. Dr. Hoffman, I enjoy and appreciate your perspective. However, you recently took a call from a gentleman who had a question about his underlying renal disease. You asked him what his creatinine was. He said 20. You were surprised that his nephrologist had not referred him for dialysis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was puzzled by that call.
Yeah.
It threw me for a loop.
Hmm.
But go ahead.
He says that this is because the patient misrepresented your question and answered with his creatinine clearance.
Okay.
Or probably his GFR.
Right. That explains
it. Which is probably 20.
That explains it. Okay, so let me comment on that.
Yeah.
So creatinine is a measure of kidney function. And a normal creatinine, the range is varied, but it ranges from about 0.6 to 1.4.
Yeah.
And above that means that kidney function is compromised.
Yes.
So, recently I saw a patient who has chronic renal failure and he has a high creatinine. It's sometimes 6, 7, 8. Mm-hmm. And, so I said, what is your kidney specialist saying, your nephrologist, in terms of when you might need dialysis? Because we'd obviously like to prevent him from needing sure. dialysis. And he said, we start talking about that when it reaches 10. So that's why I was surprised when this person said 20.
Yeah.
However, a creatinine clearance speaks to what is called the glomerular flow rate. And the glomerular.
And it's not, is it flow or is it filtration?
I'm trying to say the word.
Glomerular.
Glomerulus.
Yeah.
Which is a tiny structure. You can only see it under a microscope. It's a little filtration unit within the kidney. So the glomeruli, plural, are the little filtration structures where the, basically, they squeeze toxins out of the bloodstream and it forms urine. Mm-hmm. So the flow rate, when it's low, means that kidney function is compromised. A healthy person, 60, 70, 80, young adult. But as you get older, it declines, 40, 50. But then in renal failure, it's like 20, 10, it goes down.
Yeah.
It's also not measured directly. It's a calculation based on an equation that's taken from your creatinine. Yeah. So a 20 is not, dialysis country, but it's getting not so good.
Right.
It probably I would guess it corresponds to a 2 or 3 creatinine, maybe
probably.
High ones, certainly low twos.
Okay. This person actually, we don't have a name here, but he sent us an email. He says also TAVR.
TAVRs. Okay. TAVRs is a procedure that is designed to fix the valve, and it's done via a blood vessel.
Okay.
And
so we're not talking about kidney function anymore.
No. Another question. See, this is the corrections department. It's like in the New York Times, like on page 26, like, sorry, we got the story wrong. It's like, no, Trump didn't really say that.
this is right.
It's like,
here's the corrections department.
Right, okay.
So also, TAVR is usually a femoral artery approach, not venous.
Thank you for the correction, because actually, after the show, I thought about it because I think I said vein.
Mm.
And it's, so it actually, you thread this catheter up the artery.
Yeah.
And so thank you for the correction.
Yeah. He said not venous, unless you were referring to a transcaval approach, which is extremely rare. Dr. Bill O'Neill performs those at Henry Ford. Keep up the great work.
Well, wait, maybe there's a, maybe there's a slot for a radio show for this person.
Well, he says, keep up the great work. However, you have a large and very attentive audience. Make sure you're educating them appropriately. We want to arm them with the right information.
Okay. Well, let's
do that.
Issue that correction.
Yes.
And,
yes.
A shout out to this person because, that is an astute listener and I appreciate the constructive, criticism.
Okay. Thank you very much. Let's see here. Oh, we've got one from Jane. I've noticed on the Ostenol website that they suggest taking Ostenol with tricalcitin 3, which is calcium among other things.
I have no idea what that is.
I do.
Okay.
And that they complement each other. Is this advantageous to add tricalcitin 3 to the protocol?
Oh, is that made by the same company?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so I think I looked that up.
Yeah, I did.
Okay.
So it suggested one Ostenol with one tricalcitin and another alone per day. I'm just wondering, is this right what they're saying? Tricalcitin 3 is a combination of calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, and vitamin C. This is often in our own protocol for osteopenia.
So it's kind of like osteothera with epiflavone.
Exactly.
But it's not even quite as broad spectrum.
Exactly.
Okay.
So the makers of Ostenol also have this product that they are saying would be complementary to taking their Ostenol product.
Right. So there's no point in taking a bone morphogenetic protein without the raw materials to build bone.
Exactly.
So that's what they're giving you there with that.
Exactly. Okay. Which is calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, and vitamin C as well for the healing aspect of it. So, Jane, it would be fine, but if you're already taking something like Osteoprev or
Osteothera with epiflavone, that's currently made by Claire. They're one of our sponsors, and it's a great product. So I've included it in my bone health protocol.
Mm-hmm. So that would also be appropriate to take with Ostanol.
Yeah, it's got all the natural ingredients that are helpful for bone formation.
Okay. Jane, thank you for your question.
Good point at which to pause and allow one of our sponsors to share an important message with you, so please listen up. This should be informative.
Your brain's complex metabolism requires many different nutrients for optimum performance. Excessive release of adrenaline and cortisol, plus environmental exposures and oxygenation, may be impacting your alertness, memory, and other vital functions. This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman with a broad-spectrum neuronutrition formula that supports the central nervous system and cognitive capacity. It's NeuroThera from Claire Labs. NeuroThera provides balanced neuronutrition. Used daily, NeuroThera supports mental clarity and cognitive function. It promotes blood, oxygen, and glucose delivery to the brain and helps protect against oxidative stress and inflammation. NeuroThera provides the essential building blocks for optimal brain health. I believe in NeuroThera so much that I've included it in the Intelligent Medicine Brain Health Protocol. For more information and to purchase NeuroThera, just go to my online dispensary at drhoffmanstore.com. That's drhoffmanstore.com.
Thanks for listening, and thanks for supporting our sponsors. So what's our next question, Lila?
Let's see here. We've got one from Angela. I've suffered from recurrent UTI since my teens. I'm now 53. However, this is a female, Angela. Yeah. However, all three of my daughters suffer from the same thing. We take probiotics and eat fairly well. I've tried D-mannose, cranberry extract. I've been given prophylactic antibiotics as a preventive measure. I don't take the antibiotics preventively. I only take them when a UTI actually comes on. Can you help the four of us combat this problem? And what's the cause?
This sounds like a congenital problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of a pun. It's not a genital, it's a congenital problem. Because it suggests that something in the structure or function of the urinary tract of these women is not preventing the proper exit of the urine. There's maybe some retained urine. This is actually a fairly common problem in children, there's actually sometimes surgery that's undertaken on female children to correct this.
Wow.
So why it occurs, you know, it's a bit of a malformation of the urinary tract, and there may be a hereditary component.
That's interesting. I want to say something very, very obvious to Angela and any other female who's out there. When you go to the bathroom, you want to make sure you're wiping in the right direction.
Right. Simple
hygiene measures.
She may be already past that.
Yeah.
You know, because she seems to be well informed. She's taking D-mannose.
Yes.
Which often helps these types of things. You know, for our listeners, D-mannose is a sugar that retards the adherence
of the bacteria to the bladder.
Feet called pili that adhere to the wall of the bladder. And D-mannose, P-I-L-I. Hey, that's a good crossword puzzle word. And so these pili it prevents them. It's sort of like Teflon for the bladder wall.
And it keeps
the bacteria. Yeah. So by taking a half teaspoon three times a day, it sort of washes the bacteria out.
Right, right. Very, very interesting. Angela, we hope you and your daughters feel better. I can't think of anything else that might help the situation. Maybe the addition of a probiotic to make sure immunity is where it should be. Maybe adding some, I don't know. But if this is recurrent, this has to be congenital, because there's another reason apparently that we found out recently in the news about women having recurrent UTIs, but these are not women who've had them lifelong, but more recently. And it has to do with the prevalent antibiotic use in chicken. Women are always eating chicken.
They get colonized by bacteria.
Yes, the E. coli. There's like a mutant E. coli now that's not completely going away, and it's presenting as a UTI. In many women, more than men, apparently. And maybe it's because women are eating more chicken and trying to eat more that way and avoid red meat as so many people are still doing.
Okay, this is actually, I was looking for this word. Mm-hmm. It's called vesicoureteral reflux, or VUR. That is actually an acronym that's used for urinary tract infections that are due to structural problems in small children. Vesicoureteral reflux may make it hard to empty the bladder completely. So that's anatomic.
It's anatomic. Okay. Okay. That's interesting.
And, you know, there's surgery for it to correct it. Let's see, VUR surgery. I'm looking it up. Mm-hmm. VUR grade 4 to 5, their grades, you know, like extreme, it's higher grade. Children who have grade 4 and 5 reflux may require surgery. During the procedure, a surgeon will create a flap valve apparatus for the ureter that will keep the urine from flowing into the kidney. You know, some plumbing kind of procedure. So presumably, this woman has been to a urologist, right?
Yeah, I would imagine.
Right? I mean,
we hope so,
they would
Angela,
identify
right?
that in, sure. In her children.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, wow. We hope you and your daughters feel better soon.
I mean, Uva-Ursi has antiseptic effects. You know, that's another thing that can be applied to this.
Okay. All right.
Can only be taken for a short period of time. Don't take it forever.
Oh, now speaking of renal, we've got a little trend going here.
Okay.
This comes from Nora, who's a very concerned grandmother. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Love your show. My 18-year-old granddaughter started university before Labor Day. After one day, she came down with a kidney stone and was taken to the ER in Philadelphia in excruciating pain. Blood cultures were done and antibiotics prescribed.
Sometimes you get too busy to drink during freshman week. Except you drink other things, but not
right.
Water.
And we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
She passed the stone and was in the hospital for 2 days. I'd like to know what she could possibly do to prevent this from happening again. Okay.
Okay. The thing to Google is beer and kidney stones. Right? I'm looking it up.
Okay, but this is a very concerned grandmother, and she's likely thinking that her granddaughter is not drinking. And it's only the first week of school, Dr. Hoffman. Mm-hmm. That takes a little bit of a culture initiation to get going in freshman year.
I got to say.
But listen, 18-year-olds.
Research has shown that beer, white wine, and red wine may all help reduce a person's risk for kidney stones.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Not to recommend to your granddaughter now, who is underage, Dr. Hoffman. She's 18.
Okay, we want to encourage lawbreaking. But, you know, girls don't hydrate enough. They don't drink enough.
They just summertime is the worst time for kidney stones.
And it's
girls
hot,
don't
it's
hydrate.
Hot when school starts.
It's true, too.
Yeah.
And if she's drinking soft drinks like soda, that phosphoric acid is notorious for causing kidney stones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Add to that a more processed diet and all of that, and messing with the microbiome so that the oxalate in the food not being processed
there's
properly.
There's a certain bacteria in the microbiome that
Oxalobacter formigenes.
Beautiful. You remember the name.
Yeah,
points to you.
I wrote about it recently. Yeah, okay. So that's...
Yeah, so it is a stone-forming bacteria.
That's the one that helps break it down. You want more oxalobacter formigenes.
Oh, okay.
And oxalobacter
formigenes,
it aids the oxalate. It aids the metabolism of the oxalate so they don't crystallize into stones.
So why can't you go to the health store and buy some probiotic with oxalobacter formigenes?
Well, it doesn't have that. What the microbiome does is it forms it by having enough lactobacillus species, by having enough bifidobacteria species, by having enough of those, and a very healthy microbiome, so that the O formigenes is actually produced.
Okay, so the others encourage its production. Okay.
Nora, I would wonder, did your 18-year-old granddaughter, had she been on antibiotics recently or before? Maybe that's how the O formigenes were reduced in population, that did not allow her to metabolize the oxalate in her food, or if she's on a very high soft drink and junk food diet and not hydrated properly, that's another reason.
Dehydration. So what beverages are good?
Water.
Lemonade.
Lemonade, yes. Water with lemon.
But
and
not
when we say
tea,
lemonade,
not tea.
Not tea.
Coffee is neutral, I think.
Coffee is neutral.
Right.
So, you know, things like spinach will have oxalate. Mm-hmm. Certain people have, it's the phosphoric acid in a lot of the soft drinks. That mm-hmm. is something. And dehydration most of all.
Yeah.
And the function of the microbiota, what microbiota is there. But yeah, we're seeing more and more. Mm-hmm. We're seeing more and more kidney disease, which is kind of related, but not to the kidney stones, would you say? Mm-hmm. And it's, we're having more and more added phosphates to our food.
More hypertension and diabetes and obesity, you know. Yeah.
There's more phosphate added to our food. If you're eating cold cuts, if you're eating bacon, there's phosphates in there. Mm. For example, unless you're getting the good kind, which many people are not. So there are a lot of phosphates everywhere, more and more so in our foods. And that might have to do with the increase in kidney disease. Although the formation of kidney stones would not really fall under the umbrella of kidney disease, would it,
Dr. Hoffman? Yeah, it's in the purview of the nephrologist, but mm-hmm. kidney disease, we more think of people like we just began the podcast with elevated mm-hmm. creatinine and lowered creatinine clearance.
Right.
You know,
right.
on their way to potentially dialysis.
And lower glomerular
flow rate.
Flow rate.
Say that again, five times over fast. No. All right, before we get into trouble, let's pause and, untangle our tongues. And we can anticipate in part two what questions.
Oh, I have ischemic cardiomyopathy. Do I need to take drugs the rest of my life?
Okay, we'll field that question in just a moment, so stay with us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is our weekly Q&A with Layla, an Intelligent Medicine podcast.